Failure is not an option.
What difference at this point does it make?
Nobody said it was going to be fun.
This is Real Talk, a fearless, poignant, and intrepid show where truth speaks louder than words. This is Real Talk with your host, Audrey Russo.
The shame, not of this world, so we live on the run. We keep our eyes set, on what is to come.
It happened before. It will happen again. It's just a question of when.
Time's a luxury we don't have. Hey, everybody, this is Anson Williams. You might remember me from Happy Days. Well, I am very, very proud to have been on Audrey Russo's Real Talk. What a great show. What a great lady. What a great time.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, this is Audrey Russo, and you're listening to Real Talk. Hitler managed to turn what looked like a winning hand into a losing one in one critical year. By the end of 1941, Hitler had made almost every wrong decision possible, scoring some short-term tactical victories, but ultimately condemning his Third Reich to defeat. And we're going to find out more with my next guest as we discuss his new bestseller. During a long career at Newsweek, award-winning journalist Andrew Nagorsky served as the magazine's bureau chief in Hong Kong, Moscow, Rome, Bonn, Warsaw, and Berlin. He's also written for myriad publications. Andrew's the author of several best-selling books, including The Nazi Hunters, Hitler Land, The Greatest Battle, and his new bestseller, Hot Off the Presses, which we're discussing in this segment, 1941, the year Germany lost the war. It's my great pleasure to give a Real Talk welcome to Andrew Nagorsky. Welcome, Andrew.
Thank you so much, Audrey. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
Well, it's so great to have you with us, and I can't wait to jump into this. So, we recently passed the 75th anniversary of the D-Day invasion, a crucial turning point, of course, of World War II. In your book, you argue that Hitler's Germany, in actual fact, lost the war much earlier, in 1941. Andrew, how did you come to this conclusion?
Well, as you mentioned, I've been writing books about the Third Reich, the war, the Holocaust for quite some time. And the more I was exploring this subject and the more I looked at the decisions that were made, I realized that that one year embodied all the mistakes of Hitler. Now, of course, the war did not end at the end of 41. It was a long slog of another 3.5 years ahead, and with enormous casualties. But if you look at that beginning of that in 1941, the end of 1940, beginning of 1941, look at Germany's position then. Hitler had managed to defy the odds and take apart Czechoslovakia, annex Austria, then invade Poland, then turn to the west and invade the Benelux countries, Norway, Denmark, and then ultimately France, the big prize there. So he controlled most of Central and Eastern Europe and most of Western Europe. That there were just two major powers that were on the sidelines. One was the Soviet Union, and it really wasn't on the sidelines because Stalin and Hitler had made their pact. And Stalin was actually helping Hitler, sending him supplies. Right. The United States was on the sidelines because it was officially still out of the war. There was a lot of isolationist sentiment at home here. And Roosevelt was treading a very fine line politically on it. So it looked like he had defied the odds. He had control of much of Europe. And everybody else, no one seemed able to stop him except for one man who defied him, and that was Winston Churchill. And the story of that year, how we go from Hitler riding high to Hitler at the end of the year having basically the whole world against him, including the Soviet Union and the United States, that's the topic of my book. I think by the end of that year, it was clear that he could not win this war, even if it would take a very long time for him to lose it.
Yeah. What would you consider Hitler's biggest mistakes that brought about this great loss?
The biggest mistakes were, first of all, it had to do partly with his personality, and which is something I try to go into, the psychology of Hitler, that he was a compulsive gambler, and he had overridden even his own advisors who had warned him not to go so far so fast with all his attacks on the countries in Europe. But when he began to encounter his first failures, for instance, he thought he could crush Great Britain and make defeat the Royal Air Force in the Battle of Britain, then bomb Britain into submission so that they would accept peace on his terms. When that failed, his instinct was, instead of pulling back in any way, was to escalate further. And this leads to his major mistake at the beginning of the year, in the first half of the year, which is to the Soviet Union. That was a goal he had for ever since the 1920s, when he wrote Mein Kampf, this idea that Germany's empire would be in the East, where there are all these subhuman Slavic peoples and Jews. The Slavs would be enslaved, the Jews would be exterminated, and he goes after the Soviet Union, despite the fact that the Soviet Union had been helping him, and he totally underestimates the ability of the Soviet Union, the size, the determination of which eventually is there to defend itself, and then, but not only that, he also, instead of, he marches his armies into the Soviet Union, and in the beginning, some of the people in places like Ukraine and Belarus actually welcome them. They've been terrorized by Stalin for so long, who murdered, at that point, was a bigger mass murderer than Hitler. And he could have, if he had even pretended to be liberating these people instead of enslaving and killing them, he probably would have done much better. But no, immediately he starts on this total campaign of terror and murder, not just of Jews, but of Soviet POWs and others. And that helps Stalin rally his people against Hitler. Right. So that becomes the first big miscalculation.
You also point out that Stalin also made huge mistakes that year. In fact, you write that he and Hitler appeared to be in a contest for the title, I love this, the world's most willfully blind dictator.
Yes.
Yeah, could you expound on that for us?
Yeah, in some ways I wanted to say willfully blind was a polite way of saying it. You could say the world's most stupid dictator in many ways. I mean, yeah. Imagine you're Joseph Stalin at this point. All your own spies are telling you Hitler is going to turn against you soon. Hitler had 3 million troops ready for this invasion. You can't hide 3 million troops. There were constant overflights, which Hitler would excuse and say, "Oh, these were just training exercises." But Stalin knew his own army was ill prepared because of his own policies, where he had purged, which meant murdered a lot of his own officers. He hadn't prepared them. He didn't have the weapons, anything well prepared, and he believed he could keep this alliance with Hitler at least for another year or so. And so he refused to do anything to prepare. And when also Western powers, the U.S. and Britain, were telling him, "We also have intelligence, you're about to be invaded," In Stalin's paranoid mind, if everybody's telling me this, it's a conspiracy, and it must be wrong. And I'm going to be smarter than them. I'm going to ignore it, and I'm going to prove to Hitler I'm still his friend, and I'm not going to respond in any way. So the fact that Hitler almost succeeded at first, his troops went all the way up to the outskirts of Moscow, the result of Stalin's huge mistakes initially. But of course, Hitler made his own mistakes. He marched his troops into Russia, for instance, without providing them with winter uniforms. They marched in June. He thought we will win before the winter sets in. But there was that guy called Napoleon who had an experience back in the previous century. You would think he might have thought a little more seriously about it.
You write of Hitler and Stalin, and I'll quote, given their predispositions, it was hardly surprising that both leaders were quite capable of making major mistakes. How would you describe the relationship between the two during this period, and how would you compare their actions?
It's an odd kind of relationship in the sense that on one level, they hated each other and the worldview they believed the other represented. But at the same time, there was sort of a secret admiration that would come out sometimes. For instance, Stalin was very impressed by the way Hitler disposed of his enemies in what was called the Night of the Long Knives in 1934, a year after he came. And he had a lot of his enemies either killed or imprisoned. Hitler admired Stalin's purges and tyranny and said, you know, he, at one point he sort of half jokingly said, well, once we conquer the Soviet Union, maybe I should put Stalin in charge so he can just take it, you know, carry out my orders. So there was this relationship where they understood each other's instinct at a basic level, but it was obviously a relationship that would have to end in some sort of clash. And Hitler, because he so firmly believed that Germany had to expand and that Britain had this empire which spanned the seas, Germany could not aspire to that. The only place Germany could really have its empire was in the territory of the Soviet Union, and he believed all the vast mineral wealth, agriculture, and so forth there would make Germans rich, and without taking into consideration that Stalin had already impoverished that whole area so much that even if he conquered it successfully, it would not be anything like the gold mine he thought it would be.
Right. Another premise of 1941. The year Germany lost the war is the importance of strong leadership and forming alliances, which was clearly Churchill's forte. How would you describe the relationship between FDR and Churchill in 1941, and how did this affect the attitude of Brits and Americans toward one another at this critical time?
It's interesting that Churchill and Roosevelt, who did not, by the way, know each other personally before this time. Right. They had met once very briefly about 20 years before when Roosevelt had been Assistant Secretary of the Navy and Churchill had been First Lord of the Admiralty. But it was something that Churchill hardly even remembered Roosevelt did. And Roosevelt had a little bit of mistrust of Churchill. He saw him as this British imperialist in old school, and Churchill could be impatient with FDR, who he felt was a little too cautious politically and following public opinion rather than leading it. But they both understood they needed each other. You know, Churchill had this whole image of, we are fighting alone. We will fight at any cost. We will fight him on the beaches, all those famous speeches. But he knew ultimately he had to do that with U.S. support. He had to do it with material support. And so they began a correspondence back channel, by the way, when Churchill became prime minister, Roosevelt's ambassador in Britain was Joseph Kennedy of the Kennedy, the patriarch of the Kennedy clan, who was rather pro-German and very anti-British and very skeptical that Britain could hold out. And so Roosevelt, before, long before he replaced him, began this back channel with, of letters and messages to Churchill and going back and forth. And they developed a real admiration for each other. And that was crucial. It was, and you could also see the humor in the relationship. They would, despite all the strains, they understood that we have to rely on each other. And Roosevelt was unsure at what point to go into the war, and he didn't want to be seen as jumping into the war. Remember, the America First movement with people like Charles Lindbergh was there saying, don't go into the war at any price. We don't want to get involved in a European war again. Roosevelt understood that ultimately you have to stand up to someone like Hitler, but it'd be a delicate balance. And Churchill, by and large, respected his maneuvering and didn't try to push too far to antagonize him, but tried to nudge him along, which he did quite successfully.
Yeah, and Churchill was quite good at uniting his people, wasn't he?
Oh, yes, he was brilliant. I mean, there, you know, one of the things that struck me always as a reporter, I was a reporter, in, as you mentioned, in the Soviet Union, in Russia, in Poland, and Germany, during that whole period when the Cold War was reaching its climax and then the collapse of communism, was the role of individuals in history and how nothing that happens, these major events are not predetermined. They depend on the individuals who really guide the events, who really are catalysts for the events. In the case of World War II, in 1941, Churchill was absolutely critical here. He is the one man who stood up at first and against the Nazi tide. And there is, for instance, a very famous American correspondent of that era, Dorothy Thompson, for the Brits, meaning, but particularly for Churchill, then everybody would have lost hope that you could stop Hitler and the Nazi regime. So he really, had that strong personality. And what I found really fascinating in researching this book was that for all that public image of defiance, he had his own moments of doubt, but he kept them private. He knew he had to tell his people that somehow we're going to get out of this. Somehow we're going to win, even when it seemed really improbable at first. And for instance, when he became prime minister, he was appointed prime minister just as France was falling and Neville Chamberlain, the previous prime minister, was forced to resign. He had been the proponent of appeasement of Hitler. He turned to his bodyguard from Scotland Yard, who congratulated him. And Churchill said, he had tears in his eyes, according to this bodyguard, and he said, I hope it's not too late. Now, that's something he could reveal in a private moment, but never in a public moment. And I think that's not hypocrisy or anything like that. It's understanding the role you're playing, and at this critical time, you cannot afford to have it to show any doubt.
That is a true leader.
Yes.
Absolutely. And I think that, if it hadn't been for these qualities in his character, that relationship between him and FDR may never have happened.
Yes, you're right. I think Roosevelt certainly admired that, came to admire him it in a big way. And Churchill came to admire, even though he would, there'd be a couple, sometimes, despite all the sort of reinforcing talk, occasionally Churchill would turn to one of his aides and say, oh, those bloody Yanks, they're being slow on providing me with the supplies, and they're dithering on how much they're going to get involved in the war. But he really came to respect Roosevelt. The best example of relationship after Pearl Harbor, when he finally comes to the United States and he stays in the White House, and Roosevelt gives him a bedroom right on the same floor as his quarters. And since Roosevelt was in a wheelchair, liked to work in bed anyway, they spent a lot of time going in and out of each other's bedrooms, talking about the war and what to do. And at one point, Churchill had been in the bath dictating to an aide some speech or whatever, or a document. He gets out of the bath, puts a big towel around himself, and gets out and keeps dictating in the bedroom. At a certain moment, the towel falls, and at that moment, Roosevelt wheels into his room, and Churchill, without missing a beat, says, "Oh, Mr. President, you see, I have nothing to conceal from you." Yeah, you can't imagine Hitler and Mussolini having that kind of conversation.
No, I don't think so. Andrew, what information in 1941 is likely to surprise the readers?
Part of it is what I just said, the various doubts within the Brits and the Churchill circle. One more example of that: Harold Nicholson, who was a member of Parliament and was one of Churchill's fiercest supporters in public. Again, I discovered that he wrote a letter to his wife discussing the two pills we have, meaning the two cyanide pills they had, thinking, If the Germans do invade, if they take us, I can stand death, but I can't stand being humiliated and tortured by these guys. Right. So there are moments like that, which for me were more, this was new to me. There are also, I think, maybe the fact that the extent to which, just even in the earliest days of that invasion of the Soviet Union, Hitler was preoccupied and his lieutenants with launching the Holocaust, which you say, whatever, put aside whatever, you know, is sort of moral concerns this obviously raises, just strategically, tactically, is crazy to be busy with death squads of civilians and going into village after village, town after town, and just mowing down entire groups of the population, mostly Jews, some Gypsies or Roma, and some political people perceived as political. When you know it could have, you needed every man and every trainload of supplies for your own troops. And there's one moment where I found in the diary, for instance, of General von Buck, who was the German general who led the Central Army going towards Moscow, and when they were really beginning to get bogged down and were in pretty desperate straits in December of 41, and they're lacking everything from winter uniforms to ammunition, and he says, "I just discovered that that several trains have come into the rear of our front lines carrying Jews from other parts of Europe, obviously for extermination." And he wasn't objecting to the Holocaust per se, but he's saying, "I need those troops, those trains for supplies for my army." So even in, you know, even if again you put what Hitler was engaged in was a suicidal exercise, unfortunately, but it was also a homicidal exercise in which millions would die. And one of the other things that I try to explain in this book is that why 1941 was the year Germany lost the war was also the year that really launched the Holocaust, condemned millions to die in the years ahead. And it also, by the way, set the stage for the post-war world, because Stalin, even when he was hanging on for dear life, began to outmaneuver both Roosevelt and Churchill in terms of the shape of the post-war peace.
While 1941 clearly signaled a reversal of fortunes for Hitler, you also assert that it led to more tragedies. Would you expound on that for us?
Yes, I mean, it's setting a killing machine in motion. As to way the Germans, when they invaded Poland, for instance, in 1939, and by the way, September 1 is the 80th anniversary of the beginning of World War II when Germany invaded Poland. They already had committed all sorts of atrocities. There were all sorts of executions, mass killings, but it wasn't quite as systematic as what started in 1941. And so they started with what was called the Shoah, or the Holocaust of the Bullets, when the special killing squads were sent out to just gun to execute people with guns. But then they began to experiment with quote unquote more efficient methods, which became a gassing of the victims. First in trucks, in closed trucks, and you begin developing the death camps. So you have all of these horrors which are in the works, developing on a huge scale. So that was the human tragedy on a huge scale. And also, by the way, the Red Army POWs, at first, when so many troops surrendered to the German army, there might have been more who would have surrendered, but Hitler had them treated so badly, they were starved, beaten, killed, that within a space of, by early 1942, 2 million of them had died. So these are tragedies, human tragedies and human losses on a scale it's hard for us in today's age to even begin to fathom.
I know there's a lot of history buffs in the audience, and this brilliantly researched book has incredible reviews from the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, New York Journal of Books, Washington Independent Review of Books, Publishers Weekly, and New York Times bestselling authors Evan Thomas and John Meacham, to name a few. So, Andrew, where can the listeners follow and support your excellent work and purchase your books, including 1941, The Year Germany Lost the War?
I have a website, which is the address is simply Andrew Nagorski, written together, and Nagorski is Nagorski.com. There, I have all the links to my book and the previous books, links to buy them, links to the reviews and articles. So you can find all that in one place there.
And are you also in social media where they can follow you?
Yes, I am on Facebook. I am on Twitter. Happy to accept new friend or following requests. And always love to hear from readers.
Okay. And as always, I will have these links in my after show, which is now on the live show page. Just go to AudreyRusso.com, click on the on-air button, and right under the show description, you'll find the links and info that Andrew just shared with us. Thanks so much, Andrew, for sharing your outstanding work with us. Will you join us again on the show? Yes?
I would be delighted to. Anytime, Audrey. Thank you so much.
Excellent. Until then, may God bless you, your work, and may God save America. Bye for now.
Bye-bye.